Close your eyes for a minute. I'm going to speak a word, and I want you to listen for the word and note the mind's reaction. The word is renunciation. Be honest now, doesn't the mind go to not having any fun, no sex, no gustatory delight, no laughter, being bored and boring, or maybe even self-flagellation and all sorts of painful and depressing ascetic practices? If this is the first picture of renunciation that arises, we may all be in the wrong room. Actually, most of this picture has less to do with renunciation and more to do with cultural perceptions and our resistance to or resentment toward anything that came from our parents. More accurate definitions are the formal rejection of something, a belief, a claim, or a course of action, or an act of relinquishing or abandoning. These suggest a more neutral event. Renunciation itself has gotten a bad rap. It has nothing to do with adding suffering to your life. In fact, intelligently explored, it is integral to freedom from suffering. Renunciation arises out of the first element of the Noble Eightfold Path, wise view. If you recall, wise view is defined as the seeing of the world clearly, as it is. In particular, coming to really get that nothing we do chasing around in this world seems to bring lasting happiness. We labor endlessly for most of our lives under the mistaken belief that the next partner, the next raise, the next house, the next brownie will bring final bliss and peace and rest. It is only when we see that the way we seek happiness in fact precludes happiness that renunciation begins to look attractive. Tell me if you've heard this before. Our suffering is caused by clinging to that which we perceive as pleasant and averting that which we perceive as unpleasant. All in the name and for the sake of a me that as a stable, separate, and lasting thing does not even exist. What a scam. What a bad joke. And how sad. Philip Moffat, a former editor of Esquire magazine who now teaches at Spirit Rock, wrote a book called Dancing with Life, Buddhist Insights for Finding Meaning and Joy in the Face of Suffering. In this book, he states that when we cling to desire, the ego identity, that aspect of the mind that regards itself as me, becomes organized around fulfilling desires and starts to measure how well we are doing by how many of our desires are met. Renunciation is not about killing or weakening the ego. Good luck with that anyway. Rather, Philip says, it is about forming a new relationship with the ego such that it reflects our deeper values rather than our immediate wants. Practicing renunciation means that we consciously release certain attitudes, views, behaviors, and goals simply because we have come to see how they lead us to clinging and aversion and thus cause our suffering. These are the words of Gangaji. Stop looking where you are looking and look where you are. What bounty. Love loving you just as you are. Then, how does your life respond to that? It is your lifetime. This lifetime of attention is all we have. Where is it being spent? So if we genuinely want to be less caught in the painful cycle, We need to develop some form of renunciation practice that interrupts the pattern and disengages from the ego's drive to have what it wants. Otherwise, desires will continue to set our priorities, allocate our time, and rule our lives. We will continue to look for happiness where it cannot be found, in the improvement of our bodies, our situations, and our relationships, all of which we will be separated from in any event. Examples of renunciation practice might include intentional focusing of the attention on our tendency to cast the moment's experience into a frame of, what does this mean for me? This is known as selfing, a habit that is strongly conditioned. Or we might ask ourselves, is the mind's reaction in this moment more likely to lead to happiness or suffering? Our relationship to renunciation depends largely on how we see the purpose of this precious life. If we see it as a time-limited opportunity to get all the material and experiential goodies we can, renunciation will then look like the enemy, and we will avoid it. It is only when we begin to notice that even after all this time, all this effort, all the grasping and fleeing and attempts to manipulate people, situations, and experiences, we still are not at peace, still not contented. Only then will renunciation begin to emerge as a clear ally, even a vehicle for awakening. This is by Raymond Carver, called Late Fragment. And did you get what you wanted from this life, even so? I did. And what did you want? To call myself beloved. To feel myself beloved on the earth. So what are we talking about? Renouncing what? Well, a skillful place to begin is to take the five precepts, fitting them to our particular life situation. All are based on non-harming. Let's look more closely. Non-harming, or non-killing, of any living being. Non-harming ultimately comes to be the practice of affirming life in all its myriad forms. Not stealing becomes the practice of open-hearted generosity. Non-harmful speech and sexuality become the positive practice of using speech and sexuality for the purpose of caring, loving, nurturing our bonds with others. Not intoxicating the mind becomes finding practices which aid in our seeing clearly and cultivating those. Obviously, the Noble Eightfold Path, with its clear basis in ethical behavior, assumes certain lifestyle constraints. These can present a challenge, but in the process, they enable us to live in accord with our values. Here are some examples. Awareness of what we read and watch on TV and how much time is involved. Does this habitual action enhance life or demean it? Support awakening or arise as an obstacle on that path? And how do I want to respond? Next. Does our job, our chosen work, reflect and allow us to manifest our values? And how do I want to respond? Next, do non-essentials typically co-opt the mind? Can renunciation of non-essentials provide support for awakening? And how do I want to respond? Here are some other possible renunciation practices. First, loosening the attachment to always being right. This will dramatically alter how we interact with others and how we interpret events. It becomes easier to make decisions. The need to position ourselves favorably with regard to others and circumstances drastically diminishes. This doesn't mean giving up such things as seeking social justice, but it does leave us less judgmental and defensive, less self-righteous in our approach to life. It also actually enables us to be a more effective person. Second possible renunciation practice: committing to no longer measuring the success of life by how many of your wants are being met. You will still have desires and preferences, but they will no longer be the focus of life. You fulfill those desires that you can while living from your deepest values and abandon the rest. This means your sexual desires are constrained by non-harming, material gains are limited by the practice of generosity, and the ego need for affirmation and attention are no longer in charge of your use of time, money, and energy. It means the renouncing of measuring success by what you have or what you have achieved. This measuring is so common that it is almost entirely unconscious, and it can be devastating to inner growth. Philip Moffat says, "It is possible to fully experience the precious and beautiful moments in life as they occur, yet not be desperate for them." Third possible renunciation practice: give up being the star in your own movie. The unfolding of events in life is like a movie. Our ego interprets every scene from the vantage point of being the star. Will it be good or bad for me? Once you renounce being the star of your own movie, you begin to see the unfolding of each scene from multiple perspectives. You don't forsake your role in the movie, but once it ceases to be all about me, the movie creates less anxiety, and you are able to live from your core values. We'll end with a poem from Naomi Shihab Nye, the Palestinian poet, about a possible option. It's called Kindness. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I, kindness, that you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend.